Well, good morning and welcome to East Lake Church. My name is Kevin McPeak. I'm one of the pastors here. Whether you're here in the East Auditorium or maybe you're watching outside on the playground patio, maybe you're watching online, I'm thrilled that you're here today. Before I jump in and say anything else, because I can read the thought bubble above a couple of people's heads, and a couple of you are going, weren't you playing guitar a couple of minutes ago? And the answer is, yes, I was. And no, that was not the plan for today, but you know, sometimes things happen. And so we had somebody on the team who had a last-minute emergency come up. Everything's fine, but I had to jump in on guitar. And the reason I bring this up is that if you are a first-time guest, when you visit a church, it's kind of like flying an airline for the first time. And if you are flying an airline and you see the same guy is putting your bags in the cargo hold, comes up, serves you a drink, and then gets in the cockpit, you might wonder, hey, is this a legit airline? And the answer in that case is probably no. And if you're asking, is this a legit church, ask people who have been here a while, and they'll go, we're still not sure yet. So anyway, I'm glad you're here and watching me multitask today. If you didn't catch earlier, my last name is McPeak. And if you couldn't guess from hearing my last name, I grew up Irish. I grew up Irish Catholic in the Northeast, which is like, that's like extra Catholic. That's like Shiite Catholic. And I'm actually very fond of my family's Irish background because there are some cultural traits and practices that the Irish have that I really think are great. For instance, the Irish put a lot of emphasis on the value of family, and that's a good thing. In the Irish culture, being able to tell a good joke, being able to tell a good story, that's really important. And I don't mean to brag on the Irish, but one of the things that the Irish are really good at, I mean like amazing at, is the ability to like maintain and actually really foster and nurture and enhance grudges. My grandfather, he grew up in Syracuse, New York. And he grew up around an area called Tipperary Hill. And if you couldn't guess from the name, that's an Irish neighborhood, still is to this day. And if you ever drive through Tipperary Hill, you will come to an intersection. You'll notice something funny about the stoplight. Here's a picture of that stoplight. Now, some of you are going to notice right away what's off about it. And some of you are like can't figure it out. So I'll tell you what's weird about it. You notice what light is on the top? It's green. That's not what stoplights usually look like. In fact, in every stoplight in America, other than this one, red is on the top. And when they first put the stoplight up in that neighborhood in the 1920s, red was on the top. But the Irish kids in the neighborhood couldn't stand the thought that red, representing England, would be on top of the stoplight. So they went and threw rocks at the light until the red light broke, and the city came out and fixed it. And you'll never guess what happened. The Irish kids in the neighborhood went out and threw rocks at the red light until it broke. And this happened over and over and over because they couldn't stand the notion of the red representing England being above the green representing Ireland because they held a grudge against the English. So ultimately, what the city did is they put green on top of the stoplight. And it's actually like that to this day. So by the way, if you're colorblind and driving through Tipperary Hill in Syracuse, New York, keep your head on a swivel because you don't want to assume that that top light is red. Now, my grandfather grew up around all of that anti-English stuff. Now, my grandfather, let me tell you, my grandfather was a great man. He was kind, he was generous, he was funny. I loved him dearly. But my grandfather did not like England, and he did not like the English people. And I remember one time I was a kid, and he said something like negative about the English people. And I was like, hey, Grandpa, why do you hate the English so much? And so he proceeded to tell me a story about this English general who had set fire to a church full of Irish people. And the church burned down and killed everybody inside. And therefore, that's why you have to hate the English. And you know, let's admit, that story, it's a true story. And that's a bad thing, right? We can all agree on that. Here's the thing, I looked it up. It's been a minute since that happened. How much time, you might ask? About 375 years. Okay, this happened, I'm not making this up, in 1649, and my grandfather still held a grudge about it. We have a very, very bad event that happened before the invention of the steam engine, and my grandfather was still like fire hot mad about it almost four centuries later. It's a perfect example of something that I call Irish amnesia, which is this. We forget everything except the grudges. Now, over the years, what I've discovered is this sort of amnesia, where we forget everything except our grudges, it actually doesn't just apply to the Irish. Holding on to grudges seems like kind of human nature at this point. Mercy and forgiveness and letting bygones be bygones just doesn't seem to come naturally to us as individuals or even society as a whole. And for the past few weeks, we've been in a series called The Good Life. And we've been looking at all the ways that Jesus calls us to a way of life that's the opposite of just about everything that society tells us that we should pursue. And today what we're doing is we're looking at the words of Matthew 5, 7, which say this, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." Now that seems pretty straightforward, right? If you extend mercy, you receive mercy. Quid pro quo, even Stephen. But that's not really how the world works, is it? Sometimes when we extend mercy to other people, we don't really feel like we get mercy in return. We might offer mercy, we might offer grace and forgiveness to somebody, and in return what we get is nothing. And what happens is that can lead us to not want to really try that mercy thing anymore. Now understand, when Jesus said that we should extend mercy to people, understand the context he said it. He said that, you know, we extend mercy, but he was surrounded by people who were bitterly divided by political and religious disagreements. There were rumors and conspiracies flooding the land. There was mistrust of the governing powers. There were issues of racial and cultural identity that split people into warring factions, and they weren't showing each other a lot of mercy. So, you know, it's totally unlike today. That's my point. We're dealing with so many of the same issues that they had in Jesus' day. We're divided. We don't trust others. And we're so quick to condemn and ensure that there's retribution and punishment when people do something wrong. There's an author and a pastor named Tim Keller, and he's described this phenomenon as the fading of forgiveness. And it's connected to this sort of permanent shaming that we want to see for people who have broken trust and faith with us by doing something that we view as unforgivable. I actually believe we've entered an age where forgiveness and mercy are viewed as something kind of worse than weakness, something more like an ethical failure, because we've elevated unforgiveness and a lack of mercy as noble. And here's why. Because when we do that, it signals our commitment and our connection to that which is right and that which is good. And we contrast ourselves by flying this flag of, I believe in this good thing, and by pointing out this other person did the bad thing. So if a celebrity or a politician or just a person we know in life has a moral failure or does something that we believe is wrong, and often is wrong, we forever signal to the world, we're good because we're not like that. And as long as we cling to our unforgiveness, we make sure that there's a wall between us who are good and them who are bad. The professor and author, Alan Jacobs, described it this way. He said this, "The great moral crisis of our time is not, as many of my fellow Christians believe, sexual licentiousness, but rather vindictiveness." In other words, the great sins of our society really aren't so much about sexual issues as they are our desire to settle the score. We want to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner when we see somebody else mess up. And the teachings of Jesus are really clear on this topic. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Do you know where I get that crazy idea from the New Testament where it says this? Mercy triumphs over judgment. It's right there in the book of James. Mercy isn't optional in the feature set of Christianity. When God himself gave Moses the Ten Commandments and he declared his presence, the very first words that he used were this, Yahweh the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy. That's how God describes himself, the God of compassion and mercy. Lamentations 3 says, God's mercies are new every morning. But that brings up a fair question, I think, which is this. You could ask, okay, so how do you define that? Okay, what does that look like? What is mercy? What does it even mean? Here's a basic way of looking at the idea. Mercy is when we show compassion or forgiveness to somebody, when it's within our power to punish them, to harm them, or withhold care and compassion from them. The bottom line is that mercy comes from a decision. We decide to extend it, or we decide to withhold it. In Luke chapter 10, Jesus tells a story about three people making a decision about mercy. And two of them decide to not extend mercy. And one of them decides to extend mercy. Here's the story. A Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along. But when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. A temple assistant walked over and looked at him lying there, but he also passed by on the other side. Then a despised Samaritan came along, and when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him. Going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine and bandaged them. Then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn where he took care of him. The next day, he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, telling him, "Take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time I'm here." Now, which of these 3 would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by bandits? The man, who, by the way, in this story is a religious scholar, the man who's replying, the man replied, "The one who showed him mercy." Then Jesus said, "Yes, now, go and do the same." Now, I want to point out a couple of things about this story that show us some really important truths about mercy, truths that we ought to embrace for ourselves if we're going to be people who bring the kingdom of God into the world around us. And I want to say quickly, if you're here and you're just like checking out faith and you haven't really decided where you stand on the Jesus question, first of all, I'm really glad you're here, okay? And you don't have to agree with anything I'm saying, because if you're undecided on the Jesus issue, you can kind of do whatever you want with regard to mercy. But for those of us who have decided to follow Jesus, he's got clear instructions and requirements for us. So first, I want to point out the dynamic in the first paragraph of the story, okay? So there's this Jewish man, he's traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he was attacked and left for dead, okay? That's sort of the premise of our story. A priest sees him, crosses the street, and keeps going. A temple assistant does the same thing. Now, here's what everybody who's listening to the story would have recognized. If they were walking from Jerusalem to Jericho, they would have been leaving the temple, okay? If they were on the way to the temple, in other words, if they were going from Jericho to Jerusalem, they could use the excuse of, hey, we can't touch him because we can't touch blood, we would become unclean and we could no longer enter the temple. But they were on their way from Jerusalem to Jericho. They'd already left the temple. They didn't have the excuse to not touch this man. They're supposed to be the church people. They're supposed to be the noble ones, the good folk who look out for people. And instead, they're like, "I didn't see anything. I am not getting involved. You're on your own, because I'm not getting my hands dirty here." This highlights the first truth of mercy according to Jesus, which is this: mercy isn't afraid to touch human suffering. The mercy that Jesus is talking about in this story, it's not a clean, pristine thing. In the case of this story, it's like a kneel down and get your hands dirty kind of mercy. In this story, it says the Samaritan soothed and bandaged his wounds. That kind of mercy is not keeping its hands clean. If you've ever been in the hospital and you've been scared, you know how much of a difference it makes if somebody just reaches out and puts their hand on top of yours and says, "It's going to be okay." But it's not just our perception, our feelings that are impacted by human touch. It actually makes a biological difference. In 2013, there was this amazing study that was done. And they studied infants that were in the neonatal intensive care unit. And there were 2 groups. And one group of these infants, who, if you're in the neonatal intensive care unit, you need extra care. And this first group were provided care by being held skin-to-skin contact with their mothers. And the second group were provided care by being left in the incubator. And here's the amazing thing. They found that when they studied the kids who were held by their mom and provided with skin-to-skin contact had better cognitive function, lower stress levels, and better sleep than the kids that weren't held. And here's the truly remarkable thing about that. It wasn't just while they were in the neonatal intensive care unit when they were like that. 10 years later, when these children were 10 years old, they still had better cognitive function, lower stress levels, and better sleep than the children who weren't held 10 years earlier. It makes a biological difference. God has wired us to respond to suffering with human touch. Now, in the age of COVID, that's complicated, but it's clear physical touch makes a difference. And some of you are huggers, and you've just been waiting for somebody to say this during the pandemic because you want license to just hug everybody you know, especially me. And let me just say this clearly, please don't do that, especially to me. Some of you are going to go for the hug right after service, and I'm just going to put the hand out there, like right in the solar plexus, and just, you know, I need to know you pretty well before you hug me, and I need you to fill out some paperwork and submit to a background check, probably a 24-hour waiting period, and then I'll hug you back. I'm kidding, kind of. But getting in the mix with people who are struggling is important. Standing shoulder to shoulder with each other is good. Getting our hands dirty is good. That's one of the reasons that our church believes in service projects. Giving generously of our finances to support organizations and initiatives that do good work, that's great. But rolling up our sleeves and giving our time and our effort to help people on a grassroots level, that's critical. Getting your hands dirty is part of the deal. You might have seen earlier in hosting, we have a backpack project coming up. Sign up for that. And if it fills up, which, by the way, it will, sign up for another one of our projects when they come out. We've got a bunch lined up because we want to be out in our community making a difference. We want to be known as a church that isn't afraid to get our hands dirty. We want to go to the middle of the places where people are suffering to bring love and encouragement and hope. Now, there's another truth about mercy that this story shows us, which is this. Mercy isn't afraid to cross barriers. Now, if you jump back to that story, you'll recall it's a Samaritan that rolls by, and Jesus actually describes him as a despised Samaritan, which is rough, right? I mean, if Jesus describes you as despised, you got to think that stings a little, right? If Jesus was like, well, then Kevin walked by, and you know how everybody hates that guy, I'd be like, Jesus, not cool. Could you, like, lay off the despised part? But this Samaritan is somebody that everybody hates. Why? Because the Jewish people detested Samaritans, and the Samaritans detested them right back. The hatred between their culture goes way back, like multiple centuries, to when the nation of Israel was divided between the Jews and the Samaritans. So telling an observant Jew that a Samaritan walked by the man would have been very striking to any Jewish listener in the time, because they all felt that the Samaritans were like the bad people. Let me give you like a modern explanation to try to have it make sense. It's like saying to a Charger fan that a Raider fan walked by, right? Or it's like saying to a Broncos fan that a Raider fan walked by. It's really like saying to anybody, a Raider fan walked by. And Raiders fans, I'm kidding. I'm a Dolphins fan. My team stinks, so who am I to make fun of anybody? Also, Raider fans, please don't stab me after service. But Jesus was pointing out that mercy crosses barriers. If we want to practice that kind of mercy, we got to do the same. Extending mercy to people who look like you, dress like you, talk like you, think like you, vote like you, believe the same things you do, honestly, that's pretty easy. Jesus is making a point here, which is this. That kind of mercy is good, but I've got a higher standard that I want you to shoot for. Jesus wants you and me to extend mercy and kindness to people who are really different from us. And let me tell you, right now, doing that is incredibly unpopular in our society. Our society has become so split among political viewpoints and cultural backgrounds and racial backgrounds and economic status and language preference and blue state, red state, mask, no mask, vaccine, anti-vaccine, Marvel, DC. We're just split in every possible way. We can't interact with each other. And here's the point I don't want you to miss. Jesus is above all of it. Our phrase of the year is Jesus over everything. And all that stuff that divides us into these separate categories is actually part of the everything that Jesus is over. And over the past year, I've had a lot of people come and talk to me about how upset they are about a particular issue and how they've come to the point where they just can't extend any more grace and mercy to the people on the other side of that issue. They've had it. They're fed up. Enough is enough. The people on the other side of this issue aren't extending mercy and grace to me, and why should I do it for them? I'm tired of extending grace and mercy and getting spit on in response, so I'm done. And if that's kind of where you're at and how you feel, I get it. I really do. I understand your exhaustion. I understand your frustration. I understand you're tired of extending grace and mercy. But here's the thing. Extending grace and mercy is not optional when you're following Jesus. None of us get to opt out of that one. I checked all the fine print. There's no exemption clause. Now, if you don't like that, that's up to you, but you got to take that up with Jesus, because That's his rule, not mine. It's above my pay grade to change it. And here's what that means on a practical level. Extending mercy means you got to give something up. On a very real level, extending mercy means you're going to have to sacrifice. This highlights our third truth about mercy, which is this. Mercy costs us something. I don't want you to miss the importance of this because it's critical. Mercy is not free. And what it asks of you is totally opposed to what modern culture values. In our story, the despised, hated Samaritan, he walks up, he stops, he helps the man, he dresses his wounds, he takes him to an inn so he can heal, he pays for the man's care and tells the innkeeper, hey, if it costs more, I'll pay you the next time I'm here. He puts himself on the hook to pay the price for a man whose people and culture are at war with his own. And he could have been filled with resentment and bitterness and hatred, but he chose not to be. See, you can look at the story of the Samaritan that we just read, and you go, whoa, 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 that's not about resentment and bitterness and hatred. That's just about choosing to be kind when somebody needs help instead of ignoring them. And I'll be honest with you, that's what I thought the story told us for a long time. And it does mean that, but it also means more than that. See, it wasn't just that the Jewish people hated the Samaritans. The Samaritans hated the Jewish people right back. So when that Samaritan saw a beaten Jewish man by the side of the road, every listener in Jesus' day would have known that the Samaritan could have easily said, serves him right, and gone about his business, because the hatred between their cultures would have justified it. But he didn't. He set it all aside, and he sacrificed what he probably felt in his heart was the right thing to do, which is to get even with somebody who's different from him. And instead, he extended mercy. When we talk about mercy requiring sacrifice, we're not saying that you sacrifice your safety or your emotional well-being or your personal healing. The sacrifice I'm referring to is simply this. It's your right to settle the score. Extending mercy means I sacrifice my right to get even. And doing that requires us to take the longest of all possible journeys, which is the one between our head, when we make a decision, and the heart, where we feel it. Now, before I say one more word about this, let me be super clear about what I am not saying. Okay? I am not saying that mercy and forgiveness require you to return to an abusive, unhealthy, or toxic relationship or situation. Okay? You don't continue to expose yourself to abuse or harm out of some misguided notion of mercy and forgiveness. Mercy can be extended. Forgiveness can be extended at the same time that you maintain a healthy margin and distance to keep yourself safe. You can have margin and safety while choosing to surrender your right to get even, because those are different things. In our day and age, surrendering the right to get even is a revolutionary thing to do. On Monday morning, October 2nd, 2006, a man named Carl Roberts IV walked into a one-room Amish schoolhouse in a little town called Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania. He walked in at 10:25 a.m., and by 11:07 a.m., he was dead, along with five children that he had shot and killed. It all happened so fast. He shot these children, and then he turned the gun on himself as the police arrived. It was unimaginable, this tragedy. And a few hours after the shooting, an Amish man named Henry, a representative of the Amish community, all five of the children had been a part of that community. This man, Henry, showed up at the house of the gunman's parents, Carl and Terry Roberts. And the parents, understandably, expected that Henry would just scream at them and shout at them and denounce them, because it was their son who had shot up the schoolhouse. But instead, Henry arrived with a simple message, which was this: you are not our enemy. And he said a remarkable thing. He said, just like us, your child died today, and you're grieving. And then Henry, this quiet Amish man, he put his hand on the shoulder of the gunman's father and called him a friend. The gunman's father just broke down and sobbed. And in the days that followed, the Amish community actually reached out to the gunman's widow to let her know they held no grudge against her. And when all the donations from around the country and around the world flooded in to support this community. They made sure that proceeds from those donations went to the widow and the children of the gunman. When one Amish man was asked, "How can you do this? How does this work?" He explained that in our culture, we forgive first because mercy is already a decided issue. And then we work out our emotions over time. I'll be honest with you, when I hear that story, I don't think I can wrap my brain around that. If somebody chose to end my child's life, I don't think I could find that kind of mercy in my heart, certainly not that quickly. If I did find it, I think it would take me years, if not decades, to get there. But right away, I don't think I could do that. But I believe that this gives us just the tiniest glimpse of how the transaction of mercy works in Jesus' kingdom. Here's what the sacrifice of mercy does and doesn't mean in Amish culture. It doesn't mean that they pretend nothing happened or that the offense wasn't bad. There's a writer and bishop named N.T. Wright. He said this: forgiveness doesn't mean I didn't really mind or it didn't really matter. I did mind and it did matter. Otherwise, there wouldn't be anything to forgive at all. It also doesn't mean that there shouldn't be some consequences for bad actions. Forgiveness and mercy aren't the same thing as reconciliation. Because reconciliation requires the renewal of trust. And sometimes, you know what? That's not possible. And also sometimes, it's not a good idea. But you can still forgive. What mercy and forgiveness do mean is that we give something up. In this case, we give up our right to revenge. And we slowly surrender our feelings of resentment and bitterness and hatred. And hopefully over time, we replace them with feelings of compassion and mercy. Now, nobody would ask you to get to those points right away. In fact, I think it's such a radical change that for most of us, I wouldn't recommend that you try it instantly. But here's what I would recommend that you do. Resolve in your heart that the decision to extend mercy is a decided, settled matter in your life. It doesn't mean you're instantly going to feel better. In fact, here's what I'm confident of. You won't instantly feel better. But you can make the decision to begin extending mercy by default. That person who hurt you, you can extend them mercy. That family member that you can't seem to stop having conflict with, you can choose to extend them mercy. And that person that you see in the mirror who's done some things that fill you with regret and shame, you could extend them some mercy too. Do you know why the story of the Amish community extending mercy and forgiveness is so striking to me? Because I can't imagine deciding to forgive the person whose actions were responsible for my child's death. And yet, God forgives me. The reason that Jesus, God's one and only Son, died a torturous, painful death on the cross is because of me, my actions, my sins, yours too. And the Amish community in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania, were simply offering to someone what God had offered to them. An innocent child had been killed because of someone else's sin, and they forgave the killer the way that God forgives us. And as revolutionary and as shocking as that might sound to you, that's the kind of mercy that God offers. The reason that we extend mercy, it's simple and it's honest. Because we need mercy. I need mercy. You need mercy. We all need mercy. And our willingness to extend mercy to others is directly connected to how much mercy we'll receive. That's what that passage from Matthew says. In a moment, we're going to hear a song that speaks to this mercy that comes from Jesus. But before we do that, I want to give everybody a chance to make a decision about mercy right now. I'm not going to call anybody out. I'm not going to embarrass anybody. I'm just going to agree with your decision if you're making it. So if you do this, would you bow your heads and close your eyes where you are? I want to invite you to do a couple things. The first is this. If you're a person who's been carrying bitterness or resentment towards someone, or even you've been carrying it towards a group of people for too long, and you know that you need to make a decision to extend mercy and forgiveness, I want to invite you to raise your hand because I want to pray for you. It's time for you to let go of that burden. And the only way to do it is to extend mercy. You can keep your hand up right where you are. And I want to add to that a second group. I want to invite any of you who know that the person who needs mercy from you is you. You've been carrying guilt and shame from your past, and the only way you can set yourself free from it is embracing the mercy that comes from God. If that's you, raise your hand. And lastly, if you're somebody who knows that today is the day you need to make a commitment or a recommitment to follow Jesus, I want you to raise your hand. The mercy and forgiveness that you need is one decision away, and that decision is one you can make right now. So raise that hand if that's you. Let me pray for all of us. You can keep your hands in the air. If you made a decision to extend mercy to someone else or to yourself, or if you're making a decision today to follow Jesus, just pray this prayer with me right now where you are. Jesus, I need you. Today, I decide to extend mercy to the people around me. I make the decision to extend mercy even to those that I feel might not deserve it, simply because I don't deserve mercy, and you've still extended it to me. Today, I make the decision to accept mercy for myself, and I decide that I will accept your free gift of mercy and put down the shame and guilt I feel from my past decisions and mistakes. And Jesus, today, I choose to follow you. I repent of my past sins, and I choose to follow you today and always. Come and change me. Come and make me more like you. In your mighty name, I pray. Amen.